The following program is underwritten by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. Welcome to Humanities Connection, production of WFDU-FM and the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. I'm Bob Mann. We have two interesting segments on this episode of Humanities Connection. Later in the program, you'll be hearing about disability and social justice, but first, the voices of Montclair. Montclair, New Jersey is one of the most interesting towns in the nation. It's diverse, it's sophisticated, and you can find everything from a great restaurant to a film festival. Montclair, though, like any town in America, has changed a lot over the decades, and that's what we're talking about right now. My guest is Jane Eliasoff. She is Executive Director of the Montclair History Center, and we're talking about a grant from the New Jersey Council for the Humanities for an oral history project about Montclair called The Many Voices of Montclair. Jane, I guess you can tell that I'm a fan of your town.
Well, thank you very much. I am, too. It's a great town.
It really is a place that seems extremely progressive. I think half the New York media actually lives in Montclair, New Jersey. But it wasn't always that way. Like any place in the United States, it would reflect the bigger picture. So tell us a little about the evolution of Montclair and what you're trying to capture in this oral history project.
Well, the whole evolution of Montclair, Bob, could take hours. But
we've got 14 minutes, Jane.
But we'll talk about what the project is really looking at is the early 20th century, because there are a lot of people out there that have incredible memories of Montclair, and we want to make sure we capture them. And as Montclair is celebrating its 150th anniversary in 2018, this seemed like the perfect opportunity to do it.
We've done a lot of shows here about oral histories. It seems to be something that the New Jersey Council for the Humanities likes to focus on. But I'll ask you, as I have in these many other conversations I've had on the program, to tell us why an oral history has a special feel, what you can get and give to the public from an oral history that you might not get in a written document.
I think of the oral histories as the ultimate primary source. It really gives you an opportunity to see what people are thinking, what people lived through, in ways that you don't get in a book. A book, even if it's written by somebody, or a paper, even if it's written by somebody, it's thought about. People edit it, they correct it, they modify it until it actually says what they want the rest of the world to perceive it to be. An oral history is a lot more natural, and so you really begin to feel what people felt and see what people see through oral histories.
Yeah, we have seen this in shows that we've done about World War II veterans. And the problem is, of course, as people get older, if you really want to go back, for example, to the early part of the 20th century, you're dealing with just a reality of life, a demographic reality that these people are getting older. And there's, a certain sense of urgency to getting them. So who are you looking for the most? I know you're looking for a wide variety of Montclair voices, but where is the area where you really want a specific group of people?
I would love to get people who are in their 80s, 90s, and even 100 plus. We had one woman who was part of our documentary that we did, A Place to Become, which focused on the African-American experience in the early 20th century. And she was actually the woman who integrated the graduation line at Montclair High School in 1930. Prior to her graduation, all the black students marched at the end of the line. She was 104 when we interviewed her. She passed away last summer. But boy, is it great to have her stories on tape.
And you always will, which is just phenomenal about this type of project. We're recording this for the initial broadcast in March of 2018, but of course we repeat a lot of these segments throughout the rest of the year. So I understand that you, just as we broadcast this in late March, had your first oral history session, but you're going to have some more.
We did, and we are. We're going to have two more in April. We're calling them the Storytelling Days, and basically what we're doing is we're reaching out to people in Montclair who have that history, inviting them to come to two different locations, and then we're working with Montclair State students on this project as well. And under the direction of Chris Matthews, who teaches an oral history class, the students are going to be the ones interviewing the elders. And then from that, we'll see what happens. We might do podcasts from them. We might do broadcasts like this, exhibits. It might become part of walking tours. Who knows?
But as we do the March episode, people could sign up very soon for one of these sessions. What are you calling them?
The storytelling sessions.
Storytelling, that makes sense.
And okay. The next one will be on April 6th from 1 to 4 p.m. at First Montclair House. And the second one will be on April 21st at the Fire Department Community Room on Pine Street.
Well, I would love to think that everyone in Montclair is listening to Humanities Connection, but just in case they're not, how do people find out about this? How do you sign up? Do you just show up?
Well, we will do walk-ins, but we prefer sign-up so that we can kind of manage the crowd that's coming in. We've got tremendous response so far from the Montclair residents. And you can go to montclairhistory.org, which is our website, and you'll find the oral history programs and you'll find a way to sign up. Or simply call us at 973-744-1796.
Of course, this program is underwritten by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. What was the grant, and how much did the council help you in terms of getting this thing going?
They're wonderful. The New Jersey Council for the Humanities gave us a grant. It's what they call their incubation grant. And what it allows us to do is the research to see what we want to create out of it. So, while it is in and of itself a project, it's also collecting the research for us so that we can decide what we want to do with it in the future.
Let's talk a little bit about Montclair, because I introduced the segment by saying it's such a progressive place, you know, half the New York media, diverse population. But then you told me the story about African-American students having to march at the end of the line for high school graduation. Give us some of the stories that might surprise us about the evolution of this town.
Montclair was predominantly white up until the late 19th century. And at that point, the Great Migration happened, and Montclair was a stop on the train line. And so you had a lot of people coming up along the Eastern Corridor, as they call it in the Great Migration, from Virginia and North Carolina. And they settled there in
Montclair. Escaping the Jim Crow South, basically.
Absolutely. And they settled there. And then as family came, more and more family came, and there was work in Montclair. Not only was there work in all those lovely houses on South Mountain, but there was also a strong black middle class during that period. But there was a lot of de facto segregation that was going on. One of our sites, the Crane House and Historic Y, was built in 1796 by a wealthy white man. But in 1920, it became a YWCA for African American women and girls, a segregated space. And it was a safe haven for them. But there were restaurants you couldn't eat in. There were stores you couldn't go into. There were movie theaters, the Wellmont and the Claridge, you would have to sit in separate sections if you were African American during
that
period.
That's amazing, because at least one of those movie theaters, maybe both, are still there.
They are still there.
I go very often to those theaters to see independent films mm-hmm. that otherwise, here in the North Jersey suburbs, you might have to go into Manhattan to see that you can see in Montclair. So what created this change? How did, and I realize that we're not in a post-racial America and there are always problems.
Yes.
And I'm not trying to paint over that in any way. But Montclair, I would say, would have to be an example of how good things can be. How did that change?
I think the change happened through the people, through the African-American people in Montclair who wanted the change. We talk at the Crane House and Historic Y about how the women there learned how to become activists, both subtly as well as, you know, out there marching. And they worked within the system. But I think that Montclair also provided opportunities for the races to work together, even though there was segregation. And with the races working together, when you begin to know people on a more intimate level, then all of a sudden those barriers break down. And I think that has helped. But if you go to the Montclair school system right now, there's still concern over the education gap between the races. And the other thing I think that really did a lot to help Montclair was the change over to magnet school system, which allowed the neighborhood schools were fine, but the neighborhoods were segregated. So the schools were segregated.
So again, de facto segregation.
Again, de facto segregation.
Not something that the law imposed. It was just the way
it was. The way it was. Well, the law imposed it through redlining.
Right.
But for the most part, it was the way it was. And to this day, those areas are still predominantly segregated.
Of course, race is central to our dialogue in America right now, but there are so many other things. What are some of the other things about the way that Montclair has changed in addition to the races? I would guess becoming a New York City suburb changed a lot. It was probably a farm community.
It was a farm community up until the railroads came through. And then once the railroads came through, they really realized that there was a lot more to Montclair than just farming. And ultimately, the developers also sold the lots and bought the lots from the farmers and built the houses, which is why if you go through Montclair today, from about 1860 to about 1920 or 30, when all of that was being built up, you've got some really gorgeous housing stock. You've got every example of Victorian architecture that you could want just by walking down one or two streets in Montclair. And I think the other way it's changed a lot is that there's been much more of a, as you said, a progressive, more hip vibe that's now going on with it. You've got the film festival. You've got
Stephen Colbert lives there.
Stephen Colbert,
that alone,
right. That
should
alone,
be
right.
Enough
exactly.
To make you the coolest town in the United States.
And you've got a lot more restaurants. As a matter of fact, if I can put in another plug, we now do food and history walking tours that we've just started in the fall. And what that does is it takes people along Bloomfield Avenue, introduces them to the history of Montclair, but you get to sample food in 6 to 8 restaurants as well.
I opened up the segment mentioning the Montclair History Center, of which you're the executive director, but before the segment's done, tell the audience here in the tri-state area exactly what your center is and what you do.
The Montclair History Center has got 4 historic houses. As I mentioned, the Crane House and Historic Y. We have our administrative offices and library. There's a great archives that a lot of people come to in order to research their home or research their families or research Montclair communities. And we have a micro farm on that property as well with the Montclair Community Farm Coalition. And what they do is they grow food and then provide it to area seniors and people in need at really reduced prices. So that's our Orange Road site. We also have the Schultz House at 30 North Mountain Avenue, which is an amazing 1896 house that was bequeathed to us in 1996 and remains virtually untouched. And that one and the Crane House and Historic Y are open for tours.
The New Jersey Council for the Humanities has, as you mentioned, incubation grants. They're a little bit different from something which they call action grants. Incubation grants tend to be more on the ground floor. So looking long range, these voices of Montclair, you mentioned podcasts, but I would guess there are other things long range that may or may not happen with this project.
Exactly. And we will be looking for an action grant for them. And I think we really need to sit down, now that we've gotten our first set of interviews done, we really need to sit down and figure out what we want to do with them in the future. How will they be used? They will definitely be archived on our website and or on a digital archives that we hope to be creating and in our library. But also, what can we do to bring them out to the general public? Is it going to be through programming, through exhibits? Will they be incorporated into some of those walking tours that we do? So we will be applying for an action grant in order to get this now out from the research phase into the general community.
And why did you choose to go with Montclair State University students? What was the reason for getting them involved as the interviewers?
We've had a long relationship with Dr. Chris Matthews. He's actually an archaeologist, and he did a couple of digs on our site a number of years ago. And when we were talking with him, he said, well, oral history is part of archaeology, which I'd never realized. And as a result, he said, why don't I do a class around it? And that's how it all came to be.
I really think that this has a lot of potential. I was kind of acting almost as if I were the Montclair Chamber of Commerce here, but I don't live in your town, but I love your town. And it's very near where I work, and it's just a great place. So these many voices of Montclair, I'm hoping will become a very successful project.
Thank you very much.
Jane Eliasoff, Executive Director of the Montclair History Center, talking about the many voices of Montclair. You're listening to Humanities Connection, a production of WFDU-FM and the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. I'm Bob Mann. This program is broadcast on 89.1 FM, and then it's archived at www.njhumanities.org. And you can go to that website to find out about all of the interesting things which are done by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, as well as hearing archives of Humanities Connection. Disability rights. It's really the last civil rights struggle. Obviously, we continue to talk about race and many other things which are not yet settled in our country. But disabilities and the rights of people who are differently abled, that's at a much earlier stage than so many other social debates and discussions that go on in the United States right now. And the New Jersey Council for the Humanities has an action grant for the Disability and Social Justice Project. And we're going to be talking about that during this next segment of Humanities Connection. My guest is Lauren Shalish. She is Assistant Professor of Special Education, Language and Literacy at the College of New Jersey. Lauren, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about the idea of disabilities as a civil right and that the struggle for this is still at a fairly early stage. Give us kind of a state of the struggle update here when it comes to disability rights.
Sure. So I come from a field called disability studies, which positions people with disabilities as the experts on their own lives. And so if we look historically how the kind of term or concept of disability has evolved and how it's been used, we see that in movements for racial justice, for example, that has everything to do with disability justice and disability rights. And we haven't been maybe seen at the forefront of this work in the ways that we've hoped. And so kind of looking throughout history, we see different things happening or expressions of disability being taken up, but maybe not named in that kind of way. So you'll see, for example, we have used constructs of behavior or intelligence to diminish opportunities for other minoritized groups throughout history. So indigenous populations. We said women were biologically inferior. We had psychiatric categories to label slaves that ran away from their owner. We used the term drapetomania, that it was this psychological impairment. We considered being gay a disability until 1973.
So basically the commonality here is if somebody's different, there's something wrong with them. That was what society said.
Yeah, and we've pathologized difference, right? We've given medical meaning to understanding ways that people are just inherently different. So the disability rights movement is about understanding that more deeply and being led by people who've been labeled as disabled.
When you're talking about what you're doing, though, through your action grant from the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, you're talking a lot about children in school, pretty much in the K through 12 area, because of the fact that they've been labeled over the year troublemakers for pretty much the exact same reasons that you were just explaining in your last answer. Talk about what you're doing specifically.
Sure. So we decided to use the action grant as a way to kind of enter into these conversations, but to use this construct of behavior as a way to magnify really complicated things that were going on in our schools. And a lot of times we can see, in our schools that we conflate students who have different expressions of their bodies or behavior or speech or language as having, we conflate that or confuse it with having diminished intelligence. Or lack of theory of mind, things like that, when really it's just a matter of difference and needing to create opportunities for that expression, for opportunities to be seen and to be leaders and to be really understood. And so the way that we took this up in a K-12 setting is to use this term of troublemaker that we learned a lot about from a recently published book by Dr. Carla Shalaby with that title, Troublemakers. Is a way to understand portraits of children and how they have been labeled as troublemakers, but actually how their behavior is a form of communication. It's displaying an unmet need. And what can we learn from just viewing or understanding children differently in that way?
Can you give me a specific example of this, Lauren? What would be a behavior which may be misunderstood, thought to be disruptive, or thought to be, the mark of a troublemaker, that actually turns out to be a form of human communication? Give me an example.
Sure. So I'll use two examples here. One could be speaking out of turn in class. A lot of times we have certain notions about how students should participate, when they should speak, what they should look like when they speak. And so sometimes kids might get excited or burst out of their chair or, you know, be really eager to participate or to learn or might talk with a peer during that learning process. Often that's seen as being disruptive or maybe defiant or not paying attention or the student can't control themselves. When really, if we kind of reframe how we view that expression, it is a display of learning, of intellect. And in many cases, like Dr. Shalaby says in her book, a lot of that peer relationship building that students try to do is often misread as not paying attention when students are actually doing the work of trying to create community in their classrooms.
So what does a teacher then do to recognize that this is not bad behavior, for lack of a better term, but is a different form of communication? How does the teacher adjust, allow that student to express herself, and then also still continue to serve the rest of the class, which may express themselves either differently or in what we would consider to be a more standardized vehicle or medium for communication?
Sure. So I will say, you know, research has kind of shown us that in inclusive environments where students with disabilities are present, where different cultural and racial groups and ethnic minorities are present, that all students do better. When you, specifically in the field of special education, when you plan for and include students with disabilities, the academic performance of all students increases because you're providing more opportunity. More opportunity for choice, differentiation in how students might learn. So I'd say, you know, for teachers, the easiest thing that we can do is to provide choices or options for how students want to learn and also for how they want to display their learning or act out their learning. So a lot of times, as educators, we might feel confined by how students express themselves or opportunities that we give them to express themselves. And we, you know, only view valuable participation as sitting still and making eye contact and only speaking at certain times. But how do we kind of open up our classroom communities to not say students have to be silent and that they only talk with the teacher and that they can't move their bodies? How do we create classrooms where students can incorporate movement and be leaders and be peer supports for other students in their classroom? So offering those opportunities for choice, for expression, can help us to all do better in a learning environment.
We'll talk a little bit in a couple of minutes about where this project is going and what your future goals are. But I do want to speak in the past tense for a couple of minutes here. We're doing this initially for the March 2018 episode of Humanities Connection, but I understand that in February you had an event in which you had major keynote speakers and you had breakout sessions and talked about community organizing and coalition building. So tell the audience a little bit about what you accomplished back in February.
Of course. So we had an event here on the TCNJ campus where we brought students from Trenton Central High School, and they were given the opportunity to engage with other TCNJ students and faculty and local and national disability rights advocates. And so this was an extension of our work that we had done in the high school over the month of January. The program kind of contained a number of different opportunities for people to engage with each other and really sustained opportunities for dialogue about these topics and with people who identify as disabled. So our overall goal was long-term sustained dialogue across difference. And so what participants were able to do, we had a keynote address by Lydia Brown, who identifies as a queer autistic person of color. They talked about thinking about disability justice in liberation work. We had an offering for different breakout sessions on the topics of restorative justice and inclusion as dissent and the impact of standards-based reforms on marginalized youth. So people could select a topic that might be meaningful to them and, again, engage with other disability rights activists in the area. And then we came back together for a community organizing and coalition building workshop so people could take what they learned and become involved in the local community around an issue of disability justice or disability liberation within other civil rights struggles. So our goal was never to kind of isolate disability or think of it narrowly or as a contained concept, but to understand it as a relational one, one that has everything to do with racial justice and gender equity, and to think about these ideas and movements as broadly as possible so we could be inclusive.
My guest is Dr. Lauren Schalisch, and we're talking about the Disability and Social Justice Project here on Humanities Connection, which is underwritten by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. Now, we talked about what you've done. Let's talk about what you are going to be doing. Your goal, from the literature which you sent to me, has to do with long-term coalition building. With whom are you building these coalitions? Are you talking about K through 12 districts throughout New Jersey? Are you talking about higher education? Who are going to be some of the partners in terms of long-term coalition building when it comes to disability and social justice?
Sure. So the simple answer to that is yes. We are seeking to create bridges and opportunities for dialogue between K-12 and higher education. A lot of the work that we did with the high school students was built around a college apprenticeship model with the idea that we could learn about these issues of equity and social justice in that planning. An important piece of our planning was also the inclusion of local and national disability rights advocates. So our goal for this, with the support of the Action Grant, and the way that, you know, our student colleagues have described this in their planning, is that a lot of this work is just the beginning. We didn't view the event on February 23rd as the capstone or, you know, the last piece to this work, but as a way to begin it together and to decide how we want to move forward. And so our long-term goal is to continue this collaboration in the K-12 setting alongside local and national disability rights advocates, and to create those bridges to higher ed that are inclusive and representative for everybody. So maybe we could think more deeply about issues of access and equity for post-secondary education that represent and reflect people with disabilities.
We're doing the initial broadcast in March, but this program is likely to be repeated later in the year if somebody's hearing this in the summer, for example. What might be to be a way for them to get in touch with you, even though you know, you've already had your Campus Institute event, so that they could take advantage of some of the programs that you have in terms of disability and social justice?
Sure. Probably the easiest way to do that, we have a website thanks to the support of the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. Our URL is www.weknowfreedom.com, and this was adapted from Carla Shalaby's book, Troublemakers, which is a project about teaching love and learning freedom in schools. And so that was the platform that the students decided to use going forward as a way, because we're geographically positioned in different places in the area, it would serve as a home base for us to dialogue and to post resources and other learning materials that both K-12 educators and higher ed faculty and staff could take advantage of.
We only have 30 seconds left in this segment, Lauren, but if you can just tell those of us who may not be aware of disability as a civil rights struggle, what we might be able to do just in our lives or our awareness, something very general.
So I would say the easiest way to learn more about this is to become engaged with people who identify as disabled. The field of disability studies and critical disability studies views people with disabilities as experts on their own lives, and they're not often given the platform or the position to be in that, you know, to create that those opportunities for decision-making and organizing. And so our goal really with this project is to listen more deeply, to dialogue more deeply, to engage more deeply, and understand what the experiences are like for people who are labeled or identify as disabled.
Thank you very much. Lauren Schalisch, talking about disability and social justice. That's it for this episode of Humanities Connection. I'm Bob Mann. Thank you very much for listening. This program is initially broadcast on WFDU 89.1 FM, and then it's archived at www.njhumanities.org. You can go to that website not only to hear archives of our program, but to hear about all of the fascinating programs that are being run throughout the state by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities.